everyone, it's Lisa Z from RCP. On today's episode, we resume our conversation with Gemma Hoskins from the documentary The Keepers and her co-host on her podcast Out of the Shadows, Shane Waters. Just a little note about the audio. Unfortunately, Gemma was only able to talk to us via her cell phone. Even though we were all on a Skype call together, she had to use her cell phone to do the recording. And because of that, the sound quality is not as perfect as we would like. And you're going to be able to discern some interference and some things that her phone did to the rest of our sound, which we are so sorry about. But there was really nothing that we could do about it. And what we're not sorry about is the amazing conversation we were able to have with Gemma and Shane, and we know that you're going to be just as interested to get your update on what's up with the Keepers as we were. Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
A bombshell development. Detectives dig up the body of a priest to solve the murder of a Baltimore nun, and it turns up nothing. Sister Kathy vanished back in 1969, and WJZ continues to investigate the many twists in her case. It may be tied to the abuse of Catholic children, powerful church figures, and police.
Police interviewed Maskell before his death in 2001, but never charged him. His victims recount being terrorized.
He would keep guns in his top drawer. He would threaten me with them.
Others say Maskell had strong ties to police, officers who covered up the abuse and were part of it.
Another policeman came in, and Maskell, I could hear Maskell in the distance talking and laughing.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former head of the Homicide Prevention Unit at New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
And Redhead, and my fellow Redhead is here with us today. Who's here?
That would be me, Gemma Hoskins from The Keepers.
And myself, Shane Waters, from Out of the Shadows, where I co-host a podcast with Gemma Hoskins.
Awesome. Well, it's great having you back. And we're going to dive right back into the cases that made The Keepers so compelling.
But I seem to recall, Gemma and Shane, that in the Netflix documentary, Joyce Malecki's case was obviously talked about, although not as much as Kathy's. I mean, Jim and I always start with victimology of, you know, she appears to be a very attractive female. And was she well liked and bubbly, or did the brothers kind of give any more information about what she was like and what was going on for her at the time?
Well, you got the picture right. She was, I never met her, but from what we've heard, everybody loved her. She was smart. She was very feisty. She would not take anything from anybody. Her brothers did tell us that at one point her dad said, if anybody ever stops you, you never ever open that window or unlock those doors. Mm-hmm. And he actually had put a shotgun under the back seat for her, and he said, if anybody ever stops you, you don't hesitate to use this, even if you have to shoot through the glass. So she grew up with a whole family of brothers. She had a younger sister, but I think five brothers, big family. Mm-hmm. And they were blue collar. They lived in the St. Clements Lansdowne neighborhood where everything else happened and where all of the, you know, many of the Keogh survivors were taken to the rectory for abuse. And her family attended mass there, but she was not real involved in the church. Her cousin told me that at one point she used to watch her and her older sister get ready to go out, and they used to make fun of Maskell, and they thought he was real creepy. And so I don't think they would have been afraid of him, which would have made him very angry. He liked to scare people. Mm. And I wouldn't doubt that if she ever thought he was going to touch her sister, she would give it to him. So aside from that, I think she was just a really wonderful person. We knew that she had a job actually very close to the neighborhood where Keogh was located. and she was a killer. Everybody loved her. And she could, I just really believe that she was enough like Kathy. They actually look alike.
Right.
She was enough like Kathy to say no to that man. And women were threatened into not saying no to him. That would have been very rare. I mean, guns were used to keep girls from talking. So in terms of, she fought very hard. There was material under her fingernails, which the FBI told the family, and now all that's been destroyed. There were fingerprints taken from her car, and they're very old. They're 50 years old. They're in like a, almost like a photograph album. And the FBI told the family they really don't know if they can do anything with them. They believe the only ones that were identified were the detectives who worked over the car. So her purse and keys were found. Wait a minute, her purse was not found. Her keys were found on the front seat of the car. So whoever abducted her there brought the car back and put it in a different parking spot.
There were fingerprints found. That today's DNA technology, if they did lifts, they may have lifted skin cells and DNA may have been recoverable from those.
Her brothers mentioned that they thought that's what was going to happen. And Shane and I were like, well, I'm including him now. I'm like a dog with a bone, right? I'm like, yeah, let's get that done. Her brothers are older. They're aging. They're very frustrated. One of them died during the filming of The Keepers, who was Joyce's best advocate. It's just been a very sad situation.
I think
they were just ready to just throw in the towel. And then we said, no, we're gonna go to work for you. So that's what we're determined to do. And now they're getting a little bit more hopeful because we're actually doing something.
Right.
They did mention, though, about something about lifting almost, I don't know how it works, but lifting something from the old fingerprints. I don't know what that means. You just mentioned it.
Yeah, so the way fingerprints were lifted back then were generally you dust with some fingerprint powder, and it's very, very, very fine powder, and you put it over the surface, and when you see the ridges and the curls and whorls, you put a piece of tape over it, and you literally lift that, and then you put the tape onto a fingerprint card, and it preserves the print underneath it. And so if you now lift up that tape, you could, I mean, it's not necessarily true, but in the oils and that are left that create the fingerprint, there could be cells from your fingers in that print. And now we can get enough DNA from one or two cells to actually create a profile.
Mm-hmm. What's your perspective, all three of you, on why the FBI may have destroyed? I mean, is that something that is typical?
Destroy
physical evidence?
Let me put it this way. I have been, you know, I was in the FBI for 22 years, and I have been in offices in which literally administrators have made decisions about old files, old cases, and getting rid of them because they needed the space. And it could be as simple as that. Somebody not thinking about, well, this case is X number of years old. It's 40, 50, 60 years old. It's never going to be solved in their minds. And even though there's no statute of limitations on murder, that's not somebody who's forward thinking and thinking that technology may later be able to solve this case. And so it could be as something as simple as that. I hope it's not something nefarious. I have never witnessed something like that where somebody made a decision to try to cover up a crime in the FBI, but humans are humans. It could be possible. I don't have any of that in my experience when I was in the FBI.
You know, I mean, it can and it does happen, Jim. I think we both know that. We've certainly heard of many, many cases where things do happen consciously. You know, I can talk to the New Scotland Yard, and you know, we've had similar experience where people have been moving buildings. you know, and exhibits and things get left behind, would you believe, which seems crazy, or things just get lost, you know, and there's no real explanation as to how it got lost. So I agree with Jim. It could well be, you know, an unconscious thing, and I'd be very concerned. I don't want to put two and two together and get five. But the hallmarks of this, given that, you know, from what you've said, it sounds like there has really not been a thorough investigation in this case. And from the fact that I think it was 2014, this FOIA request went in. That's an extremely long time to just be put on hold. That wouldn't be acceptable in the UK. And I'm not sure what the governing body is here for accountability. Because at the very least, if there's 4,000 pages, it may not be their top priority, but it should be a priority given the fact that there are multiple young women that are missing or have been found murdered. That is the FBI's business if these cases are linked. And I think that's the real concern, that if these cases are linked, I'm going to talk about some of the others, because it's not just these two. There are, in fact, a number of them, and potentially at least four of them could well be linked. And I certainly have a problem. I'm working multiple cases at the moment of young women and girls who just go missing and no one does anything. That to me is unacceptable. And who are the people making the decisions not to resource these cases? That accountability, I think, is something that does need to be transparent. We do need to know there are names of people here. And I always think, you know, going to the top, I think that's the right decision. You know, sometimes you have to, you know, it's the mountain of Muhammad, isn't it? And you've got to do what you've got to do. And maybe Jim's got some other advice about how and who you might be able to speak to. But I'm very concerned about these missing women and that have turned up brutalized, because actually Joyce was brutally murdered, and she was found, was it face down with her throat cut, with her hands tied behind her back. And then we've got multiple other young women that have been bludgeoned to death, and that didn't happen on its own. And this should be a priority for everyone, quite frankly. This could be anyone's daughter that this happened to, and I feel terribly for the family that in all this time they've had no update from an official. That is unconscionable. It really is, that they haven't had anybody talk to them with regards to what's happening, which, again, it leads me to think that two and two is coming up with five, that people are trying to hide things here, and it feels for all the wrong reasons. And I'm sure that's probably a conclusion you've come to. You don't really want to travel in that direction. But sometimes, you know, when I worked in New Scotland Yard, people felt if they gave no answer, and if they hid in their office, that they weren't accountable. And I'm talking about senior leaders, you know, and that accountability, the names of people, who was the investigating officer and what did they do? When you've got 4,000 pages, it says that there's something that exists, you know, and forensics being destroyed, that can happen it can happen at times, but it just seems very bizarre in the wake of multiple other cases that could well be linked. And the fact this perpetrator or perpetrators are still out there. And Jim and I know very well that offenders don't just stop. So it's still a public protection risk here. The cases are that we know about. There'll be many more, unfortunately.
To my knowledge, the church has never voluntarily released any documents pertaining to the clergy abuse crisis.
Terry McKiernan's organization, which has no affiliation with the church, has published abuse documents from about a dozen archdioceses and religious orders, but says in each case the files were released only after the church was legally forced to do
so. If these two cases are linked, or if four of these cases are linked, and you're getting into a serial offender, and those offenders, many of them will not stop until they are arrested or they die or they're incapacitated in some way. We do find some offenders who are able to sublimate their desires and get into some kind of situation in which their desire to kill takes a back seat, and they manipulate or coercively control or abuse someone, and that's enough to satisfy them at a certain time. And it looks like that's what happened in the Golden State Killer case, that for a period of time. He went from breaking into people's homes and getting sexually aroused by stealing women's underwear. And then that lasted for a period of time. And then he raped women. The lowest estimate is 50 women, but the likelihood is that he raped many hundreds of women. And then he stopped doing that. And then he started killing, raping and killing men and women. He became a very prolific serial killer. So then he stopped. And we have not been able to attribute any more murders to him, you know, over the period of over three decades. So it's really interesting how some do find a way. And it may be something that snaps in their brain where it's a chemical change or an imbalance or something that turns off in their brain and they don't desire to kill anymore. But it could also be that they've found someone they're hurting enough, that they're feeling that sadistic urge satisfied enough that they don't kill. And when you tell me that Maskell liked to scare people, like to frighten people, that's an indicator of sadistic nature. And that's something where an offender gets off on causing and witnessing the suffering of others. And that's literally like sex to them. It's something that doesn't make sense to the average person, but this is what drives a sexual sadist. So I'm concerned that was his psychological makeup. And mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then it's very possible that he was responsible for murder. It's not a huge leap. Those people who are sexual sadists, they're turned on by causing that pain and suffering. And it could be that he took the next step. I don't know.
I was going to say that Gemma and Shane have found a couple of more murders, like a year after Joyce Malecki's murder, almost to the month, was Pamela Lynn Conyers, a 16-year-old girl who was strangled and raped. And then a year after that, Grace Montaigne, 16 years old, in October of 1971. Her skull is crushed by cinder blocks, and it looks like she might have been tortured with some cigarette burns. So somebody is killing these girls on a fairly regular basis, almost to the month. And you feel like they're connected somehow.
Right. What I'm going to share with you, I want you to keep in mind the names Billy Schmidt from The Keepers, who was Kathy's neighbor, and Edgar Davidson, who was the guy that came home the day after Kathy disappeared with the bloody shirt. Because we have found someone who can connect both of them to each other and to Joseph Maskell. And what happened with Pam Conyers, who was after Joyce, was she was found on the median strip of highway that was under construction. And nobody but the construction workers or the police would have had access to where she was found, because it was blocked off.
But when you say that, I mean, that it's a construction site where they weren't working 24 hours a day. There's plenty of people that get access to that. And I know of other, you know, certainly organized crime cases in which they used construction sites to get rid of bodies. But, you know, I'm not disagreeing.
Frequently traveled.
Right.
The Schmidt home where Sharon grew up, with her parents and her brother, was a mile and a half from there as the crow flies. And Pam was strangled, which is the same way that Kathy was strangled and hit with a blunt object. Grace was hit with a cinder block. And of course, Joyce was, her throat was slit, but the resemblance of the girls is remarkable. Most of them had strawberry blonde hair, very pretty. Grace was in the newspaper as winning a teen beauty pageant. Mm. And we believe that the perpetrator spotted her in the newspaper. And then in the articles that we sent you, somebody, either a man using like with a trying to sound like a woman or a woman with a deep voice, called all these girls asking them if they wanted to audition for modeling. And most of the girls they called, like Grace Montagna, is a last name that would be easy to find in a phone book. And 120 some girls called and said, yes, they called me. and the girls either said no or the person didn't show up. Mm. But she was picked up. She told her parents that she was going to practice for a fashion show, which was not true. But the woman that called and said, we'll pick you up at your school, don't tell your parents because this will be a nice surprise when they see you in a fashion show. Mm. So she took the bait. A woman picked her up. We think, honestly, that it was Edgar in a blonde wig, same car Edgar drove, and took her to wherever. She was found very, very close to Archbishop Keough and the neighborhood where a lot of the Maskell abuse and the cop abuse happened. She was found face down. Her face was beyond recognition because it really was a cinder block. It wasn't a brick. Mm. And whoever did it, this is horrible, but they spread, she had beautiful long hair. They spread her hair all around her head like a halo. Mm. And
so that's staging.
Hmm. Okay. She had been tortured with cigarette burns probably before she was killed.
So what you just said, well, a couple of things. The torture with cigarette burns, that's consistent with a sadistic behavior. The posing like that and the staging could be an indicator that this offender was making a statement. In other words, wanted to shock and really disturb those who found the body. I mean, it sounds like a really gruesome scene, but with that, the spreading of the hair and a halo, that could be that they were mocking whoever was going to find it or the person that they mm-hmm. just killed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horrible scene.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was also, Gemma, I read that she was described as sort of an angel.
Yes.
Everyone yes. really liked her, bubbly, intelligent. You know, I think the victimology is key in this, in these cases, because these are standout girls, aren't they, and women. These are head turners.
Edgar Davidson's own niece, Debbie, told us that he would take her when she was a child to ride around and try, and she's called it stealing girls off the street. And I never understood what she meant, but he really did try to get girls to get in the car with him. And my feeling has been that he's been involved in a lot of this. Now, he was not a rocket scientist by any means. He was really a thug, but I do think he was one of Maskell's enforcers. And he was like the tough guy that would, you know, manhandle and... I just see him involved in every one of these. And we don't know what the police know, which is so frustrating.
And circling back just to the last case that we were talking about, Gay was her nickname.
Yes.
I think it's very interesting that it is her face and head that's targeted. And you know, for her face to be brutalized beyond recognition, it sounds to me that that's much more about targeting who she is and the anger and the rage, you know, and possibly about her being unobtainable to whoever it was. And I think it is interesting in that case that it's a confidence ruse to get her into the car. It's a setup and it's premeditated. So she was targeted.
Right.
35 people saw her.
Right.
She was, get into
she was
car.
Identified when they were watching the newspaper. There used to be a whole section in our local newspaper called the Teen World or something. And everybody that was winning awards or cheerleaders or beauty pageants were all in there with their names and their bios. So we feel like a lot of, you know, it was easy to target her, to find her, and then to say, would you like to be part of this modeling audition? And she said yes.
And she wasn't just a beauty queen. She was the cheerleader and yes. the cheerleader mascot, right?
So exactly.
She kind of stands out from the crowd. She's the popular girl that probably most girls want to be like. And I think that's unique here. And the fact that other women and girls did call the police afterwards, didn't they? And said that they had similar approaches at shopping malls about modeling. And I think that that is a vulnerability. It's an easy way in. Con young girls because it's using their probably their insecurity about what they look like, but in another way, it's using their vanity. You know, if I'm making you special, you're someone that stands out, and I want to, you know, photograph you. Don't tell your parents. So trying to create secrecy. And this is probably someone who's done that hundreds of times and has approached many women.
Right. So that's also an indicator, as Laura said, of a level of sophistication. If somebody is using a sophisticated con like this and knows how to manipulate their victims, they've probably been thinking about this a lot. And so it's not impulsive behavior. It's not behavior that is just acted out in the last minute. It's something that they're fantasizing about, planning, doing a lot of prep for. And so I think that's the kind of offender you're looking at here.
Have you heard from the church?
Not directly.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the Archdiocese of Baltimore is claiming there were no reports. On the other hand, we have been privy to a number of individuals and families mm-hmm. who have shared with us that they did indeed report right. the abuse to right. both the school administration and to the Archdiocese of Baltimore.
Yeah, something confident. And to get someone to a secondary location, and we talk about this a lot, or we have done in previous podcasts, saying, you know, if someone tries to get you to a secondary location, never go. Fight at the point where you're at. Of course, if you've got someone conning you that you're going to do a particular activity, that you're trusting that person, and that could be an easy way to get all these women back in their cars and driving to another location. Or, of course, a gun equally. Is normally something that gets someone frozen into taking instruction about moving from location A to location B. But I do think the cars are interesting in these cases. Kathy's car being brought back and being illegally parked, well, that tells you that it's somebody who knew where Kathy lived at the very least. Offenders do learn what works, and they evolve their modus operandi as they go along. And of course, in these cases, you have got things that are slightly different, but you have got somebody who is sophisticated to a degree that whoever they are, they're still out there. And some of that's by luck, because these cases don't appear to have had a thorough investigation, and they certainly don't seem to have been looked at together as a potential series.
Yeah, and what Laura just pointed out, and this is really significant, is the reason why the car was returned to that location. There's two effects from that. One is that it made it appear, at least on its face, that she didn't drive somewhere, that she didn't go to another location, right? So people wouldn't be looking for her to have been driven somewhere or driving somewhere. The other result is that they have spent more time with evidence that they're connected to the crime. That means that they most likely had a known connection to the victim. In other words, if Kathy was abducted at a store, or Kathy was abducted out in the woods on a hike or a run or something like that out in the public, then there would be no reason for that person to then bring her car back to her place. That increases the risk for the offender dramatically. Mm-hmm. So typically that's only done when there has to be some kind of subterfuge in which they're trying to prevent people from knowing that Kathy is missing so that they have time to get away and establish an alibi, because people know that the two of them were to be together or have mm-hmm. a known relationship. So it's much the same way that people who are known to have a relationship with a victim actually spend time on concealment of the body, because offenders who don't know the victims can just leave them there in a public place. They don't have to hide them. They don't have to secrete mm-hmm. them in the woods. They don't have to spend time burying them or something like that. So in this mm-hmm. case, you have her secreted in an off-the-way place and her car being returned where she lived. So those are two indications that the person who did this had a known relationship with her.
Yeah, most of us feel like, Jim, that it was the neighbor, Billy, who lived across the hall from her, because he was obsessed with her. The Schmidts feel like their family was involved in this, but his, if you look at the picture of the car, you can see his sliding glass door right across. He could, like, 10 seconds, he could have been back in his house. And if he had driven her car into the lot and put it in her spot, then he risks being seen getting out of her car in her parking spot. So,
I think that's a reasonable assumption. Very interesting.
I have a question for you guys, since you've seen The Keepers. What did you make of all of those weird stuffed animals in Edgar Davidson's apartment? Do you remember that episode? He was the one that our director questioned, and he said he didn't have anything to do with it. He's the one that came home with the bloody shirt and told his wife he'd gotten in a fight. And he was being interviewed. He called, they showed him pictures, and he said, well, that's Maskell. And then he said, and that's Kathy. It wasn't like, that's the nun. And then he's got a whole bedroom full of stuffed animals, like 40 of them.
Well, yeah. I was much more concerned about his domestic violence history. And
absolutely, yeah.
Strangulation of his wife, which we know that strangulation increases the risk sevenfold when hands go round neck. You know, once someone does that, they never go back. And of course, she went back to him, didn't she? She got pregnant. Am I recalling the right couple?
Did she Edgar's.
Get Uncle Edgar's
wife? Yeah, that's...
She left him because of the abuse, and then she went back, didn't she?
And then went back to him. You're correct. Yes, you're correct.
The necklace. She's the one who had the necklace, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that behavior and the fact that she was so fearful of him, you know, really does speak volumes. And he was interviewed, wasn't he?
Yes.
I mean, on creepometer value, he scores high, for sure.
And the stuffed animals could be nothing more than obsessive behavior. When you have things like that, there are people that get into really weird things that they get obsessed on, and it could be something paraphilic, or it could be something that has nothing to do with sex with them. So I can't really opine about that, but as Laura said, the creep factor was really high with that guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was also going to say, just before Jim interjected, was that the animals, where do they come from? Are they animals that he has stuffed?
I asked. One of his daughters told me that that's what he always wanted for Christmas and birthdays, was a stuffed animal, and that's what they gave him. And I'm like thinking, okay, well, yeah, the creep factor is definitely there.
Right. I mean, animal abuse is a high risk factor. And we can't say that those animals were abused, or but anyone who enjoys watching animals suffer, or sadistic behavior, or the hands around the neck, that's a sadistic behavior, and that's a power and control related behavior. And so on many facets, he scored various ticks for warning signs for me that this person is a concern. That doesn't necessarily make him a murderer, but the domestic violence aspect does connect. I've worked many cases, and in fact, my research showed that 1 in 12 domestic violence rapists who are raping in the home are raping outside the home. You know, I would want to certainly hear more from people who have had intimate relationships with him, and he certainly is somebody who is on my radar in terms of risk and concerning behavior.
Shane and I are going to make some overtures to the medical examiner in Baltimore and go there and see what we can find out about some of these cases. I'm very convincing once I get my foot in the door. And we're going to also track down some of the family members and see if they'll talk to us, the Conyers family and Grace's family, and see what we can come up with. And then maybe we might have more direction and more that we can share with you guys.
Great.
That would be great. Great. Well, it was great to see you guys.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing all the great work you guys are doing with us on Real Crime Profile. Until next time, signing off.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233. Thank you.